Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. With COVID-19 surging yet again, local hospitals are overwhelmed, and that can affect anyone in need of critical care. And later, a new exhibition headed to Bakersfield showcases contemporary artists like Jean-Michel Basquiat and David Hockney. But first, we continue with the latest installment of our new podcast, Escape from Mammoth Pool, all about the dramatic rescues of hundreds of campers during the first weekend of the Creek Fire. Today, a story about heroes. I'll let KVPR's Carrie Klein take it from here.
It was the Saturday before Labor Day last year, and Joseph Rosamond got a notification on his phone. He was at his home in Manteca, a mid-sized city 150 miles away from Mammoth Pool Reservoir, and he was planning the long weekend with his family.
It was right around 4 o'clock, 4:30 maybe, and that's when I first got a text message from our facility commander and saying, hey, there's a rescue. Who's available?
He's a chief warrant officer with the California Army National Guard, a helicopter pilot. Chief Joe, some call him. The details of the mission were slim, but he was interested. He'd been flying over wildfires for more than 2 decades. He just had to check in with someone very important, his 5-year-old son.
We were going to play some Zelda together. And I was like, hey, man, there's all these people that are trapped. You know, there's fire coming at them, and dad needs to go help them out. You think you can let me go? And he was cool about it, you know, and it's like, yeah, dad, go ahead. I'll see you later.
His wife and daughter gave him a thumbs up, too. So he started packing a bag, getting ready for a mission that would prove to be the riskiest thing he'd ever done. There are many ways to be heroic. Some are death-defying, some are not. And even talking someone down from a panic attack or offering a ride in the middle of a wildfire can pay dividends in serendipitous, even life-saving ways. And so, even though by many measures what happened at Mammoth Pool Reservoir last year was a tragedy, the situation also revealed some of the best of human nature. This is Escape from Mammoth Pool by KVPR, NPR for Central California. I'm Carrie Klein, and in today's episode, the heroes, big and small, who enabled everyone to get out alive. While Chief Joe was preparing his helicopter and briefing his crew, Carla Carcamo was trapped at the lake, replaying the last conversation she'd had with her sister. It was late afternoon, but dark as night, as the fire made its final push around the lake.
Within minutes, we were surrounded. We were like basically in a ring of fire.
And that meant her siblings and cousins were in danger. They had left for a hike that morning and hadn't been heard from since. Carla's teenage sister had wanted to hang back with her at the campground, but Carla encouraged her to leave. She'd said, go on, go have fun with our brother.
And I just kept thinking, like, if I wouldn't have said that, she would have been with me. She wouldn't have been with the boys. She wouldn't be lost, you know, like a lot of shouldn'ts and a lot of could'ves and a lot of would'ves were going through my mind, you know.
She waited, unwittingly imagining all the horrible things that could have happened. But then
everybody started screaming.
2 trucks had emerged from the forest, and Carla's prayers were answered. They were carrying her cousin, her brother, and her sister.
I ran so fast. I ran so fast. And as soon as I got there, I hugged my sister. And I just kept telling her, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, baby. And all she said was, I wanted to stay with you. And I said, I know.
Then Carla looked down.
She had like blisters on her arms and her hand, and she had blisters on her legs, and she was just shaking. She was shaking.
They had literally run for their lives and busted out onto the road where the trucks had rumbled by. Carla's siblings were burned, but their cousin was hurt even worse, with broken bones. She'd been accidentally thrown from the truck she was riding in. As soon as the burn victims had appeared, Carla snapped into big sister mode. She passed out Gatorade and Pedialyte she'd stashed in her cooler. She even pulled out a bottle of hydrocodone that she'd been prescribed for a shoulder injury.
We were like giving out that medication like it was freaking candy. We were like, take two, drink water, stay hydrated.
And it turns out another camper was a nurse. She set up in a trailer and got to work dressing the wounds while Carla scanned the tree line for the one cousin who was still missing. As the firestorm died down, people began emerging from their vehicles, trading near-death experiences like war stories. Vicky Castro and Rolando Rosales clambered out of the water with their kids. Alex Tenamonte and her husband Raul Reyes got in a huddle with friends to start planning food, water, and shelter, thinking about survival. They assumed any rescue missions would be coming from the road, which could take days to clear.
We're not going to be up here for the next 24 hours. We're not going to be up here for the next 72 hours. I was thinking minimum 5, 7, maybe even 10 days.
But while they were planning, they were surprised by another vehicle driving out of the smoldering forest, this time an ATV.
It was black, like a black hole from where they were coming. They were coming from this road. Like, where the hell did they come from?
People ran over, bringing food and water.
They're trying to catch their breath, and they're like, there's some guys trapped at the creek.
They'd seen a group of men huddled in a quad in the water, and they looked injured. It was more news Carla had been waiting for.
He was like, yes, we found five guys. He goes, like, between the ages of 25 and 30. And I was like, oh my God. I screamed at him. I must have scared him.
One of them matched the description of her cousin. The guys in the ATV hadn't had room for them, so they'd bombed it to the lake to get backup. They rounded up a handful of volunteers, most of them strangers, and a few more ATVs.
These people did not hesitate, not once, to say, no, it's too dangerous to go. They were just like, no, let's go.
The search party returned to screams of joy and tears. Carla's cousin had lost his shoes, and his feet were so badly burned he had to be carried. But he and the others with him were alive.
So I ran back to my aunt's truck, and I started banging on the window. And I was like, Dia, I'm like, they found him. And she just threw herself out of the car.
And her cousin had a friend with him, a puppy they'd found cowering in the quad, a husky, Vicky and Rolando's dog, Loki, who'd been thrown from a truck hours earlier.
The guys that they found in the razor, they didn't want to let him go. Because our dog had basically sat with them for the most part of the fire.
By 7 p.m., Chief Joe and three crew members were in the air. They were in a Chinook, basically a flying tank with two massive rotors. And as they approached the fire, they linked up with a second helicopter, a Black Hawk out of Fresno. The sun was setting, and the conditions were dismal.
The visibility immediately dropped from clear when you're on one side of the fire to almost zero when you're on the inside of the fire. For a moment, I was like, oh, man, this is really bad.
But then they discovered the glowing remains of trees below them.
I could see all these little pinpricks of where the terrain would be based on that burning vegetation. And it was almost a relief. We're like, oh, wait. We can actually see.
The constellation of embers lit their way straight to the lake. Once there, it was the sound of the rotors that reached the campers first.
Everybody was screaming.
Everybody basically started cheering. And they started saying, turn on all the lights so they know that we're down here.
Car headlights, flashlights, cell phones. I mean, anything, and just everyone was just screaming, yelling, honking.
The Chinook landed first on the boat launch. They'd been told they were picking up around 30 people, maybe 30 families. Obviously, both were an undercount. The crews stuffed people in, burned victims first, then women and children. The Chinook left with 65 people, the Black Hawk with 15, and within an hour or two, they were all being triaged at Fresno Yosemite Airport. Around 10 p.m., the choppers landed a second time. The smoke was getting worse, so they made a decision: load up. The crew piled in as many people as they could in case they couldn't make it back again. It was only once Chief Joe started up the rotors and felt the sluggishness of the chopper that he realized just how full they were.
It's designed for 33 people in seatbelts, and we took 102.
It was standing room only, and the back ramp couldn't close. Crew members had stretched cargo straps across the open door to hold everyone inside.
That was definitely a wide-eyed, white-knuckled, at that point, like, I had run out of outs. At that point, we realized if something happens, if an engine quits, if something with the airframe fails, we don't have an out. Like, we are going wherever gravity takes us.
Were you scared for your life or for the lives of the people on that chopper?
For that 20-minute time span, yes. Yeah. There was nothing for sure in that 20 minutes.
The helicopter pilots and their crew members had accepted this mission without knowing how many people needed rescuing or even where they were going. And even though they'd flown countless wildfires, many had never done it at night. Chief Joe kissed his kids goodbye, knowing he was doing something he'd never attempted for people he'd never met. It's a mission that will forever stand out for him, even compared to active duty in Kuwait, in Iraq, in Afghanistan.
And I've done, you know, night air assaults into bad guy country and doing all this other stuff. I've been shot at, but this was by far the most dangerous, most risky thing that I've ever gotten myself into.
Around 4 a.m., 12 hours after those first text messages, the National Guardsmen finally made it to their hotel rooms, exhausted and reeking of smoke. The choppers had each taken 3 flights, transporting 242 people and 16 dogs to safety. And they weren't done. Over the next few days and nights, they'd airlift another 150 people trapped by the fire out of the High Sierra. And so it's fitting that a few weeks later, their heroism was recognized by the highest authority possible, the White House. Chief Joe, the Black Hawk pilot, and their 5 crew members were awarded a prestigious military honor, the Distinguished Flying Cross. Typically, a general would present them, but this time, President Trump flew out to California to pin them on the men personally.
You know, that's basically the highest award that you can get for aviation service. Just extremely humbled. Couldn't really ask for more. And that was pretty amazing. Pretty awesome.
There were so many conditions that aligned in favor of rescue that day at Mammoth Pool. The abundance of vehicles, the low water levels, the emergency cell service that allowed 911 calls to set the rescue in motion. And there were so many heroes, not just the National Guardsmen. Raul credits the other members of his off-roading club for thinking fast, like the friend who jet-skied them to the trucks after their hike. Alex's hero was Raul, who helped her stay calm by telling her to call 911. And Vicky and Rolando, their heroes were the people who brought their kids to the lake and rescued their dog. And, of course, Alex and Raul, who stuffed them into their truck.
When I was running, the smoke got so thick, like, I couldn't breathe anymore.
I can't even imagine what could have happened if they weren't there to take us.
Carla has so much gratitude for the pilots, for the men who rushed back into the forest for her family members, and for the nurse who took care of their injuries.
When we got to the hospital, they said, "Who did this? Because it's so good. Like, if they hadn't cleaned the wounds the way they did, they said it would have been a lot worse. They said that everybody would have had infections."
At times, Carla is shocked they made it out alive. Every one of them. It's a feeling many of these campers share. And they're right. It's all so incredible, it's almost hard to believe.
When I tell the story to people, I just tell them, you know what? It was like a movie, but in real life.
In the next episode, an epilogue, how all these families are doing a year later, including a surprise lawsuit. That's next week on Escape from Mammoth Pool.
Subscribe to Escape from Mammoth Pool wherever you get your podcast, and you can find photos and more at kvpr.org. New episodes drop on Fridays. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. With extremely high COVID-19 hospitalization rates in the Central Valley, pediatricians are warning local doctors to be on the lookout for a related condition found in kids who have been exposed to the virus. KVPR's Madi Bolaños reports.
6-year-old Bryce Moore shouts from one side of the small soccer field where he is practicing for his first game. His mom, Fresno resident Jennifer Moore, describes him as a happy-go-lucky kid. But 9 months ago, he was anything but that, she says. Moore and her husband tested positive for COVID in November 2020. She says Bryce, then 5 years old, tested negative and didn't show any symptoms associated with the virus.
And so my husband and I got through that and recovered. And then at the end of January, we picked him up from school on a Friday, and he had a little bit of a headache.
That was nearly 2 months after she and her husband contracted COVID. When Bryce woke up the next morning, his headache was worse. He developed a fever, refused to eat, and on Sunday, she says he could barely walk. So she reached out to Kaiser Permanente's advice line.
And they got us a video appointment and saw him, and they were concerned he had meningitis.
Moore rushed him to Valley Children's Hospital where, she says, the doctors ruled out meningitis. The doctors sent them home, but 2 days later, Bryce was still in a lot of pain, with a fever, bloodshot eyes, and a growing rash on his back, she says.
It was quite difficult to see him go through that.
It took 2 more visits to the emergency room before doctors finally asked Moore if Bryce had been exposed to COVID in the last few months.
And through that, it came up that my husband and I had COVID. And it was like it clicked right away. They knew exactly what it was.
Doctors diagnosed Bryce with multi-inflammatory syndrome in children, or MIS-C, a post-infectious phenomenon that is occurring in children, according to Dr. Reshma Patil, pediatric rheumatologist at Valley Children's Hospital.
It is not a disease or syndrome itself. It is essentially what I like to call a tornado or cascade of events that's happening when the immune system is on overdrive.
MIS-C cases tend to increase following a spike in COVID cases, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That's why, as schools reopen amid a surge driven by the Delta variant, Patel says she's been working to educate pediatricians across the state on how to identify and treat MIS-C.
And so right now we are seeing a big surge in the Delta variant and rise in COVID-19 infection cases now, especially in the unvaccinated populations. And so we are bracing ourselves for a MIS-C surge soon to follow.
The symptoms for MIS-C include fever, headaches, neck pain, redness of the eyes, lips, mouth, hands, and sometimes even vomiting or diarrhea. Because it's a new phenomenon, doctors have a hard time diagnosing it, she says. But the most obvious sign is if a child has these symptoms and has been exposed to COVID.
It is occurring about 2 to 8 weeks after the initial COVID may have been present in that child.
There were nearly 5,000 reported cases of MIS-C and 41 related deths in the nation as of August 27th, the CDC said. That included nearly 600 cases in California. The Fresno County Department of Public Health did not have data on local cases and referred KVPR to the Children's Hospital. Patel says the data is currently unavailable due to a, quote, failure of reporting, but the hospital is addressing the issue. While Miss C is considered fairly rare, it is disproportionately hitting Black and Latinx children. Dr. Eric Fernandez y Garcia is an associate professor of clinical pediatrics at UC Davis. He says overcrowded housing and other factors could explain this overrepresentation.
Black and Latinx workers tend to work in locations and in jobs where there is more frequent contact with people.
And given the number of COVID cases in the Central Valley, Jennifer Moore says she's concerned about Bryce's health as he enters kindergarten.
So there is that fear there, because I know we do our best to stay safe, but we don't always know what everybody else is doing. But also, I want him to be a kid.
That's why she's also urging parents to take the virus seriously and follow CDC guidelines until a vaccine is available for kids younger than 12.
They may not get COVID directly, but that doesn't mean it can't affect them in other ways.
These days, Bryce is back to playing soccer with his neighborhood friends. But his mom says because the long-term effects of Miss C are still unknown, doctors will continue monitoring his health. With KVPR, I'm Madi Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Yet again, Central Valley hospitals are overflowing with COVID-19 patients, which has stretched our medical systems thin and created disturbing consequences for anyone in need of critical care. To learn more about how hospitals are coping with the most recent surge, I spoke with Donna Hefner, President and CEO of Sierra View Medical Center in Porterville, Dr. Danielle Campaign, Medical Director of American Ambulance, Dr. Robert Ferdman, Assistant Chief of Hospital Medicine at Kaiser Permanente Fresno Medical Center, and Dr. Kenny Bond, Director of the UCSF Fresno COVID Equity Project. So first of all, I just want to thank all of you for taking the time to talk with us today. You know, but I have to say, it is really discouraging that we're still talking about the toll that COVID's taking on our medical systems. And I can't imagine how frustrating it must be for all of you who have been on the front lines of this pandemic for the past year and a half. Donna Hefner, I want to start with you. You know, as the CEO of Sierra View Medical Center, I understand it's been a really difficult past several weeks. And I'm wondering if you could just give us a sense of what this surge has been like for your hospital and how it has differed from previous spikes in COVID hospitalizations.
Yes, thank you very much. In regards to this pandemic, we actually identified the first patient in Tulare County back in March of last year. And from that moment, it really became very vivid in regards to what we needed to do as far as responding to ensure the safety of our staff. But when we hit about April of this year, we started to plateau here. At that time, around April 30th, we'd already seen hospitalized 1,229 patients with COVID. And so the next couple months were us catching our breath and starting to really kind of touch, check in with staff in regards to how are they feeling, you know, coming out of this surge that we've experienced through the winter months. And we were starting to turn that corner about July. And I remember July 5th, coming out of the 4th of July holiday, is that we'd already identified 10 cases in Tulare County with the Delta variant. And as a result of that, you know, the next 30 days, we started to see the rise of hospitalizations. And, you know, it was on August 9th that surge began, and we became in a critical state as far as being able to staff our licensed beds. So, you know, this became a staffing issue and has been for the last 30 days for us. And it kind of goes back to what we were seeing with just the turnover of staff last year. It was significantly higher than we had seen in previous years. And based on our benchmarking in California for RN turnover, we were definitely higher than that. We were at 16%. But January to to August this year, we've had 17% of our RN workforce leave to go travel. And so that also created an increased pressure on us in a rural area, not only to care for those with COVID symptoms, because what we did as a result of the increased surge in August with patients needing COVID, we went back to the same systems that worked for us last year in that we isolated one entire unit and all of our staff were in all the right PPE and all of our patients were in the unit with the right filtration systems and all of those things that worked. But the volume of patients presenting to the ED was a mixture now. It was not all those coming with COVID-like symptoms. There were a lot of patients that had presented with non-COVID-like symptoms that were in need of emergent care. And that volume alone for our 18-bed facility, we were seeing upwards as high as I've seen 59 individuals in the department seeking care. So it has been definitely challenging this time in regards to the staff we've been able to bring in from travelers. You know, prior to one of our goals in this organization was to retain our staff. And we realized that 56% of our staff, we have 1,016 employees, were less than 5 years. So we've had a goal for ourselves to try to increase that retention level. And so, but with this turnover, we haven't been able to make strides around that. That also causes us to have to bring in additional staff to help backfill, and that comes in the form of hiring agency staff. And so we have had 19 travelers in at this time helping us with that. We have a number of our employees that are out on a leave of absence caring for themselves or for their children. And that also presents some challenges because we can have we have over 100 employees out on a leave of absence of our 1,000 employees. So those are all some of the challenges. On a positive note, we have been the site of Tulare County that we are administering the monoclonal antibodies. So we average about 3 to 4 patients every day that come in with COVID-like symptoms. And one of our registered nurses spends about 2 to 4 hours with those patients and gets the administration of the Regeneron. And that's made some strides. We've had a great increase in acceptance of vaccines recently. And so that's all been very encouraging. But to date, we have treated over 1,634 COVID patients hospitalized, and we are, just in the last couple days, have seen our numbers starting to decline a little bit, and that's encouraging.
That has to be welcome news. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ferdman, you know, you've been on the ground dealing with this throughout the pandemic, and I'm just wondering if you could give us a sense of what it is like to be now dealing with this new wave of COVID patients, given that many of these severe cases could have been prevented with a vaccine.
Absolutely. So since the end of June and even into now, our numbers rapidly increased from into July and into August. And we were definitely a little bit more prepared this time around compared to previous years in terms of, you know, PPE equipment, respirators and things like that. The things that we've seen, as many other facilities have seen, is that the diversity of the population of people that are coming now with this COVID infection from previously last year, we were seeing more older people, people with a variety of different comorbidities. But this year, at least in our hospital, we're seeing more patients that are younger, in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, some people without any significant comorbidities. So it's a significant impact on a variety of different ages, different populations. And of course, it's affecting our unvaccinated people the most. Those are the people that are coming into the hospital, staying in the hospital longer, leading to more burdens and more workflow into the hospital flow. And at the same time, A lot of these people are being requiring higher levels of care, impacting our ICUs and staying in the ICUs longer. So a lot of the patients that we've seen here at the hospital as well, prior to last year, we were able to use the medications we had and turn them around pretty quickly, you know, over just maybe a couple of days of the treatments from the treatments that we have. But with this new variant, patients are staying longer, patients are sicker, patients are much, much more compromised in various organs. So in our impact into the hospital, initially we saw great impact on the hospital floor, but now we're seeing more and more patients requiring higher levels of care. Our ICUs are beyond capacity, stretching our physicians, our nursing staff, but our nursing staff and everyone's in, you know, good spirits in terms of trying to help these patients, being in contact with families and doing what's best for our patients. But even then, so our ICU is beyond capacity, beyond impact, and these patients are staying in the hospital, especially those in the ICU are staying much, much longer, weeks and weeks on impact. What we're seeing right now is that, you know, fortunately, we're whether or not we're turning over the hump is kind of what we're seeing right now, where the hospital is not as much impacted as it was. However, we still have several COVID that are still in the hospital, still very, very sick. And with that being said, the ICUs are being more impacted. And what it's ended up doing is for a lot of patients that are needing the resources, needing hospital care for various other non-COVID emergencies are being impacted as well, both in the hospital setting as well as in the ICU as well, that need that little higher level of care. So COVID has not only an impact on just COVID patients, it has an impact on all different kinds of patients. And that's what we're seeing greatly affecting the hospital. More and more patients are not getting seeking the care that they need, outpatient or inpatient. And what they're doing is they're coming in at higher levels of acuity, higher levels of sickness, and leading to longer stays of hospitalization. So COVID has a large, large impact in terms of hospital levels of care and the acuity of patients that we're seeing in the hospital. But right now, we're definitely seeing a turnaround in the hospital needs for patients, like I've mentioned, but our ICUs are still greatly impacted and are still greatly affected by this COVID infection, largely from our unvaccinated patients. Now, right. You know, people say that, you know, vaccinations, I can still get it with unvaccinated. Yes, you can still get it. There's never any claims about this. However, all of our patients that are vaccinated in the hospital with COVID do fantastically. They are able to leave out of the hospital very quickly. They don't have any significant severity of diseases. There's no long-term impacts in terms of severe oxygen requirements and other impacts that COVID has left to these patients. So overall, the vaccinations are doing their job, and we're hoping that more and more of this realization of what's going on in the hospital, we'll be able to get more and more of our local patients vaccinated and hopefully, you know, preventing this further surging.
Dr. Bond, can you give us a sense of what it's like in the emergency department in terms of the volume of folks that are coming in? You know, one thing that I have heard is that there's a significant portion of people who are showing up at emergency rooms who are symptomatic, but don't necessarily need hospitalization. So they're essentially using the emergency room as a testing center, which can't be a particularly good use of resources at a time like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that plug too, since I split my jobs with a few different roles. So yes, I still work as an emergency medicine physician downtown at CRMC, the trauma center in Fresno, but I also run the largest testing and vaccination center in the San Joaquin Valley here with the COVID Equity Project. So I'm here right now talking to you from the vaccine center while we're trying to vaccinate, and we've had a huge surge in testing here. So we certainly have, you know, we're doing 700, 800 tests as an outpatient. And then I go work in the ER, and we have different zones where we triage people based on their acuity. And there is certainly still a large number of people coming into our low acuity tent zones where, they have very likely have COVID but aren't going to be hospitalized. They don't feel well, so they're coming into the emergency department, but that they really just need to stay home, stay safe, stay isolated, and come get tested at outpatient and testing centers like ours or through your primary doctors and other places that they can get taken care of. It's really been, from a resource stance, and I'm sure Dr. Campaign will touch on this a little bit, we in the ER have issues where we have a lot of patients being boarded, meaning there's no places to put anybody, and that leads to greater lengths of stay, as well as extended stays for people calling the ambulance for other emergencies unrelated to COVID, where people are staying on the ambulance gurney because there's no place to put them in the emergency department. I work at this center during the weekdays, and this weekend I'll be working in the ER, and then next week I'll still be working in the ICU as well, just covering the COVID ICU. So it's like we're all, as far as it's a staffing issue mostly at this point, less of a ventilator issue and more of not, there's not enough nurses and doctors to take care of all the COVID patients. So yes, we have a Delta surge. Yes, it's a surging, but two things we can think about is what's the best appropriate way if you have a fever, don't feel well, what we can do, what you should do at that point. We should have some better education on that. But also, of course, as was mentioned earlier, almost all the patients, 88%, I believe, in the hospital right now and about similarly that are coming through that are COVID positive are unvaccinated. So despite the discussion of monoclonal antibodies and current treatments and, you know, other alternative therapies that are kind of going a little wild right now on the internet, is that the most important thing you can do to protect yourself is honestly is just get vaccinated.
Dr. Campaign, this is a perfect time to bring you into the conversation. As the medical director for American Ambulance, can you talk about the resource issue for local ambulances?
Yes, definitely. And thank you for bringing up that great question. So just like the hospitals are getting hit hard, you know, our ambulance agencies are getting hit hard too. You know, so American Ambulance is a very large ambulance provider for the San Joaquin Valley. And one of the things that happened recently is basically too many people are calling 911 for emergency care, and there's not enough ambulances out there to respond to them. And mostly that's also a staffing issue. And so what's happened is there is a policy that just got put out by the county. It's called Protocol 571, but basically it's an assess and refer policy. So you have abdominal pain, you have something else going on, they come out and assess you and then say you don't meet criteria for an emergent transport. And I think this is a very shocking protocol. So most people in the Valley, when you call 911, you just expect an ambulance to show up and to take you to your hospital of choice. And now, of course, if they assess you and you're hypoxic, meaning your oxygen levels are low or you're not breathing well, there's a big criteria. You know, if you're short of breath, you're having chest pain, of course, they're going to take you. But for the minor injuries, it doesn't mean you don't have a medical emergency, though. You could have appendicitis, right? You can be calling to have abdominal pain and vomiting. But if you meet a certain requirement, they're going to say, okay, but you have to go by private car or you've got to go by a taxi or get a friend to take you because the system is stretched too thin. Another thing that's happened recently, and very similar to how the East Coast was in their surges, is there's a policy 406, where this is basically when you call 911, this is the EMS agency's way of ensuring that there's ambulances available for high-priority life-threatening emergencies. So if you call 911 for your car accident and you're severely ill or chest pain or shortness of breath, of course the ambulance is going to show up. But if you call and say, you know, I don't feel well, I'm a sick person, or I've got long-term back pain, they're going to put you like in a queue and like a waiting line. And it might be hours before an ambulance comes. And this leaves an available ambulance then to respond to the next car accident or the next medical arrest, cardiac arrest when your heart stops. So we're kind of trying to do all these things to save ambulances for the most sick person, because a lot of people are calling the ambulance who either just feel really sick because COVID does make you feel bad, but they might not need an emergent transport. And I think that's a change in our American way of thinking, right? We mostly think if we call 911, an ambulance should show up and take us to the hospital. But once again, this is a precious resource. And I think as a community, we need to save this resource for the most sick people. And just like the other physician spoke from Kaiser and from Sierra View about, you know, human capital and resources, our resources in the agency at American Ambulance are stretched thin too, because we have people getting sick, people with COVID themselves. You know, I feel like the EMS system is really the unsung heroes of this COVID pandemic. You know, they go into people's homes with COVID. They're sitting in a small back of an ambulance with them while they transport them long distances. And they've been out there just like all of us on the front lines for the past 2 years doing this. And right now we're short on paramedics, we're short on EMTs, we're short on people. There's enough physical ambulance to drive. There's not enough people to staff them. And so due to this, the county EMS system has put out these two policies to kind of help decrease the burden of the EMS on the hospitals and not transporting the people and saving it for the people who need it the most.
Dr. Bond, I'd like to circle back to you quickly. As the director of the UCSF Fresno COVID Equity Project, you are out there working to increase access to vaccines. How is that work going? And what are you hearing from people about what is motivating them to finally take that step to get vaccinated?
Well, thanks for that question. So we've definitely seen a big ebb and flow in vaccines where when we started, we could not get enough vaccines. We had lines and lines and miles to get vaccinated. We have everyone trying to get their vaccines. Then, of course, we sort of got the people who are really eager to get it. And then we have this large group of essentially vaccine hesitant and at some point vaccine resistant or anti-vax group as well that is difficult to break into. We still have a large group where there's an access issue. We run 30 to 45 mobile events and target certain communities, those with low access to healthcare within the region, and communities of color, in particular with migrant farm workers and African-American populations, where you look at some of the clinics, they're not as spread as well distributed through those areas. And so there's some hesitation in that. And a lot of it is just misinformation, I have to say. There's a lot of concerns over pregnancy and health, and there's so much Facebook doctoring going on and scare tactics that there's just a lot of scared people. And getting trust in the medical community is difficult. Some of these, we do have to understand that some of these groups have historically not been treated great by society, the government, and the medical community as well. So we have to recognize that to earn trust back, to make sure that they know that this is their best option. This is the way to keep them the safest. We get so many questions about, like, you know, pregnancy being a most common one, where people are, young females have very low rates of uptake because they're scared about getting pregnant. And they know that there's actually greater risk from losing a pregnancy from getting COVID and being unvaccinated than there ever is a foreseeable potential risk, which doesn't exist really for pregnancy in the setting of a COVID vaccination. So there's just a lot of work we have to do on that. But there's unfortunately forces that are trying to counter us at that. You're asking about the flow currently, and we basically did have an uptick in about a couple weeks ago, last month, when mandates started coming around with both testing mandates that you or vaccine mandates where you had to get vaccinated or had to get vaccinated or get testing. It both took an increase in testing amounts as well as vaccinations. And I do think the Delta surge that has happened in the region and nationally has honestly scared some people that thought they were, I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm safe, into getting vaccinated. So we are back essentially into a little bit of an upswing, which is, it's unfortunate that you have to, you know, see some family member get sick of COVID or something like that or have a workplace require it. But we do have certainly an uptick in vaccinations in the last couple of weeks.
Well, that is encouraging news, at least. I've been talking with Dr. Kenny Bond with UCSF Fresno, Dr. Robert Ferdman with Kaiser Permanente Fresno, Donna Hefner with Sierra View Medical Center, and Danielle Campaign with American Ambulance. Thank you all for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. A never-before-seen collection of works by contemporary art legends like David Hockney, Helmut Newton, and Jean-Michel Basquiat is headed to the Bakersfield Museum of Art. The exhibition, titled On the Edge, is comprised of more than 150 objects from the private collection of LA-based art enthusiast Joan and Jack Quinn. In advance of the exhibition's opening on September 30th, I spoke to Joan Quinn about the close relationships she enjoys with many of these artists and why she wants to exhibit their works here in the Central Valley. So take me back to how this collection got started and its roots in the friendships that you and your husband had with the artists themselves.
We go way back to middle school when I was very friendly with a woman named Dora Delarios, who was an artist, but we didn't know what artists were at that time. And as I grew up and I went to high school, I was working at a department store in Los Angeles, and I met Billy L. Bankston, who was working in the prop department. And then I went to USC, and I met people in the art department. I met Kenny Price and I met David Novros and some of the other artists at USC. And then I worked at the law school and met my husband. And long story, we were married and we continued our interest in artists. I brought artists to our marriage and he brought law. And it was like a community, you know. We were all young. We were all starting our careers. Jack helped the artists with their legal problems. And we brought the artists to meet young lawyers who were interested in meeting somebody outside of their, you know, field.
And then talk about some of the ways that you promoted artists, particularly through your work as a journalist with publications like Andy Warhol's Interview Magazine.
I always thought that artists could not actually toot their own horns. It was that kind of a thing where they would be stuck in their studio painting, sculpting, doing whatever they had to do, and they couldn't get their work out. And many times, I think the galleries didn't do a very good job. So I kind of took it on myself to make sure that the people that we were friendly with in our artist community were always known. I would make sure that if we did a party and after an opening, that I would send a press release to the newspapers to make sure that people knew that, say, Billy Al or Peter Alexander or Ed Moses just had an opening and there was a dinner party for him afterwards at a particular restaurant or at somebody's home.
So my understanding is that many of the works in this exhibition are portraits of you and portraits of family, portraits of your family. What is it like to have your likeness rendered by, I mean, truly some of the greatest figures in contemporary art?
Well, I must say, Kathleen, that I don't look at it as a portrait of me. I look at it as a portrait or a painting of someone who just happened to be sitting for that artist. And that this person, Joan Quinn, is like a bowl of fruit. And she's just sat for all these other people. And they all paint her in a different way. And the one thing about the portraits is you see the artist's hand in every one of the portraits. I think they're showing an Al Ruppersberg portrait of me in Bakersfield. And it's Al's nose. It is not my nose.
That's great. So what, if any, connection do you have to the Central Valley?
I'm an Armenian girl born and raised in Los Angeles. My family came to California. My grandparents came to California and started a life in Los Angeles. And I remember as a child seeing lugs of grapes or some fresh fruit in the kitchen of my grandparents' house. And it had come from maybe my grandfather's sister or from a cousin in Selma or Delano or words that I didn't know what they were, but the bounty was fantastic. So I grew up kind of hearing that in the valley. And then my father used to promote races. He had this big race that he would promote in Sacramento. And then he would go out into the community like Visalia and Delano, Hanford and Fresno and take the race drivers with him and do press in those cities to draw people in. So I was always raised with that feeling and the names of all those cities.
How did the exhibit at the Bakersfield Museum of Art come about?
First of all, we've never shown our work before. We showed it once at a private school in Los Angeles, maybe 10 years ago. We showed a portion of it when the private school was opening their new art department. And we arranged to have it there for the students to see because we always like the education part of what we do. There's a component that's very important to us. So I don't know, we went to a show of Lisa Kitchens. I went to a show of Lisa Kitchens. I went to a show of Chuck Arnaldi. And early on, years ago, Laddie Dill had an exhibition there. And somehow, Rachel Wainwright, the curator, found me and asked if I would do something. And I was very hesitant. I said, no, I didn't want to do anything. It's very personal to have your art go out and have people see it. So I was quite against it. And she persevered. And we talked about the idea that it would, that we would have workshops for the students in Bakersfield, that we would have outreach, that we would have this educational component to the exhibition. It was in a small community that I was familiar with. I liked the idea that it was small, and it was very personal. The museum's small and personal, and I feel like our collection is small and personal too.
You know, given how personal this collection is, I mean, you had such close ties to these artists and your family is so integrated into these works. What I'm wondering if you could just say a little bit more about what it's like to share these pieces of art publicly, and what do you hope the public will take away from experiencing it?
I think that's a really great question, because it just all goes back to appreciating the art of our time, but it also goes back to education and bringing the youth into a museum, and having young people look at something like a Ganser. Jim Ganser has made a lamp out of a pair of shorts. He was an artist who used found objects. He made, there's a table that he calls a table, and it's three palm fronds as the legs and a very small book on top. And it's really not a table, but he called it, you know, his table. He also made a lamp out of a pair of boxer shorts. And those are the kind of things that can influence students to go home and try something that would be really interesting for them to explore. Woods Davy, we have a sculpture of Woods Davy, and it's a pile of rocks on top of each other. And you know, I think a young person wouldn't think of putting rocks on top of each other, or maybe they want to paint them, or maybe they want to do some kind of installation on their own. I think it's inspiring that way. Chuck Arnaldi works with sticks. Who would think that sticks could make a, you know, could be a piece of art? And if you see the way it's put together and the quality that it feels like and the way it moves you when you look at it, I think all of the things that I've talked about move you in a very personal way. Like Ganser's pieces are very comedic and it brings a smile to your face. And I think the Woods Davy rocks make you think about the environment. There's always some way to think about what's going on around you.
Well, I've been talking with Joan Quinn, whose private collection of works by some of the 20th century's most celebrated contemporary artists will be on display at the Bakersfield Museum of Art starting September 30th. It has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on the show and for sharing your collection with our community.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you, Kathleen. I look forward to seeing you at the opening.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.